The Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. We don't have a quorum, but we have staff from DPS to begin our presentations, and we'll have several briefings with the DPS, but who's going first today? Assistant Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Mark Danaski. I'm the Assistant Commissioner from Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Members and Mr. Chair, Commissioner Nolman, sends her regrets. She's in Representative Hornish's committee giving opening remarks this morning, and she'll be stopping back over sometime later on this morning. Once again, thank you for allowing us to give an overview of the Department of Public Safety's divisions. First up this morning, we have the State Fire Marshal, Jerry Rosendahl.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Rosendahl. Would you like to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Jerry Rosendahl, the State Fire Marshal with the Department of Public Safety. I believe you have a fact sheet on the State Fire Marshal Division. I'm not going to go through that in detail. Just highlight a few of the areas that you requested we discuss. The State Fire Marshal's office was created in 1905, and at that time the mission was to provide investigations of fires in the state to determine cause and origin and circumstances, and then secondarily to accumulate fire reports to review that kind of data. Those projects are still with us today, but certainly along with a host of other programs, which you'll see on the fact sheet, and there's a listing of the programs as well as a number of statistics with each of those. You asked us to talk a little bit about successes and challenges, and I'll go through those at this particular time. One of the successes, I believe, in recent two, 3 years is a project we've labeled Shared Fire and Rescue Services, and it's a grant program that 2 years ago provided $200,000 that you appropriated for out of the fire safety account. And we had eight applications, and we were able to award the $200,000 to those eight communities. And those reports, actually, the feasibility studies that were done with that money are available on our website, and produced literally hundreds of ideas on ways that communities could join together and share services for either a more efficient operation or efficiency as well as cost reduction. But cost reduction wasn't necessarily the only benefit out of those particular studies. The other area that I think is a success is in recent years we've increased our efforts towards training local fire departments in the area that we specialize in, which is primarily the more the fire prevention aspect, from fire inspection services to fire investigation services, along with fire and life safety education and youth fire setting information. One of the challenges we're facing right now, actually, is that we have a very stable workforce that's been with us for a long time, and a lot of baby boomers, and we're getting to a point of succession planning for over the next 2-3 years is a very hot button with us, as it is with many other agencies, certainly. But our management team at the highest level, is many of them are in that category where they'll be retiring out here in the next year or two. So we're working on training up our supervisors at the lower levels, if you will, and believe we're ready for the succession that'll come about. Another challenge for us is in the area of fire fatalities. We had, a couple years ago, we had a low of 39 for the year. Last year, or 2011, we went to 56. And this past year, 2012, although we haven't finalized the numbers, we're going to be in the low 50s again. And what we're seeing from those fire fatalities out there is, even though all the work that's being done in fire prevention areas and things, we're seeing that there's a particular target audience that is more and more difficult to get to, and I'm speaking of drug use, alcohol abuse, hoarding houses, and those kinds of things that just kind of complicate issues when we get into what is more typically the type of season when we have fire fatalities, and that's such as this morning, with the colder temperatures, and heaters, furnaces are turned on and whatever, because the top three causes of fire, structure fires, are still in the area of cooking, heating, and such as candles and things like that. I think in the area of efficiencies, over the last few years, we've been able to develop an online fire incident reporting system that our fire departments use to report into us, which literally goes back to our 1905 charge of maintaining fire reports and analyzing that kind of data so that we know what public education programs to do, so that we know what fire code enforcement activities we should do. We have around 98% of all 785 fire departments in Minnesota reporting in on that system. This is either the highest percentage in the country or maybe second. So we're very proud of that, and that this makes everything more efficient. We're also kind of have been able to develop what we'll call for our inspectors and investigators that work out of their home offices all over the state, essentially a mobile office with technology in terms of laptops and printers in their vehicles and the ability to connect to the cloud with fire reports and all those kinds of things. And the third, I think, in that area is the coordination that our office staff are able to give to local fire departments that don't have the resources, specifically in the area of fire and life safety education and youth fire setting. So our staff of one in each of those areas essentially is not doing those things, but coordinating as best they can with the local people and providing resources to them. As far as trends, looking to the future and trends that we're currently seeing, one in the area of fire investigation teams. We have 11 investigators with the chief plus the chief investigator, and are called upon by the local authorities to assist them in difficult or complex or fatality fires or suspected arson. Essentially, the responsibility to do fire investigations is at the local fire chief level, but we provide that additional service when they request it. And what we're seeing developing now are countywide or just region-wide fire investigation teams, where a number of departments will go together, and they'll be able to keep their team members more proficient on fire investigations because they're doing more fires. They're going over to assist the neighboring department. A fire investigator in a rural, especially even suburban community, they don't get a lot of fires to really do a lot of investigations on. So if they go to more, they're more professional, more efficient on doing those. And we're seeing those tiered kind of investigation teams put together, where it might be just the local fire marshal, or it might go to the area team, and then it ratchets up to us. So we're kind of assisting them when necessary. Another trend, we're seeing some really good work come out of the Shared Fire and Rescue Services program, where I believe in one county where there's four fire departments, I believe that it is absolutely possible that we'll see a countywide fire department come into being, making use of the four fire departments. There'll be four fire stations, but it'll be one fire department with some ability to consolidate administrative services, training, like equipment and training and things like that. And I see that as a trend, and I think that's a wonderful thing to look forward to. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I'm just curious about how the staffing, how this works statewide. So, I mean, these folks, are they all located in St. Paul and then go depending on the kinds of inspections that are needed? How does that, logistically, how does this work?
Mr. Chairman and members, we have approximately 30, might be on the fact sheet here, the actually breakdown. There's 21 inspectors, and most of the supervisors actually work out of their home office. And they're spread throughout the state. So they go from their home in the morning, they hit the road, and they're going to one of their inspections directly from the home office. So we have obvious shorter time frames on responding to those. The investigators are in the same situation. They're spread throughout the state. They work out of their home office, go directly to the fire scene, location, whatever it is, from their home office.
Is it possible to get sort of a map to see how that all works? How many are in the metro area, or is that...
We've actually, Mr. Chair, members, in the investigation area specifically, we have actually reduced the number of fire investigators that are specifically in the metro area due to a lot of increased activity and going to more full-time staff, and this investigation is one of those areas. So we've reduced our numbers because the locals can handle it. And I forget if there was a second part of your question.
No, I thought that, I mean, I was intrigued when you talked about the trends for the possibility of a county fire department, because, you know, a lot of countries actually handle these kinds of things very differently, and like it's unusual in some countries to have, you know, how many police departments do we have in the state here? Several hundred, I think. And a lot of countries just have one, you know, sort of state police force. I mean, in the Western countries, and it, so I think that that's probably an interesting idea for the future. I don't know if politically if it ever worked, but I, Representative Ward, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, kind of. Mr. Rosendahl, you know, a few years ago we changed how we distributed education dollars to the around the state of Minnesota for firefighters. Can you report back to us how that's working with the new formula, with the new process of distribution to fire departments statewide?
Mr. Chair, members, the when the fire safety account came into being July 1 of 2007, one of the intended uses of that fund is to the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education. And through now we're in the fifth round of providing funding to local fire departments for where it's a reimbursable program where they've spent money to train their firefighters. There's actually this fifth round now, we're up to $105 per firefighter that can be reimbursed back to them based on the funding out of this account. It's a tremendous program. It is well received pretty much everywhere. We don't have every fire department actually still taking advantage of that for reasons that we're researching, but it's well used, and a lot of money been spent out for training, a ton of training going on in Minnesota, and the levels of training through specific targeted programs within the Board of Firefighter Training and Education have raised the level of training in for firefighters across the state.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And then my last question is the shared service program. I did have some interest in that kind of a program up in my old district. So can you tell us, I see that there were 8 awarded applicants out of the 13. Can you tell us the distribution statewide that happened on?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, we are in the process right now of finalizing the grant agreements for those 8, and essentially being told that until we finalize those, that we haven't put out the information yet on who they are specifically. But they come to your geographical question. They come from all over the state. And I could provide a map on the first round where they are, and then when we finish agreements, certainly provide a map of the second round.
Representative Ward.
And then thank you. And so it is geographically distributed around the state of Minnesota, as I heard you just say. And then secondly, so there were 8 out of 13. Is this a program that's going to continue annually and have the applicants that were not awarded have the opportunity in the future to start doing some shared service at work as well?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, due to the success of this program, first round, certainly we went from 8 applicants to 13, and I know of a number of those that missed the deadline or they weren't quite ready to get all their units of government and fire departments ready for the second round. We've had a lot of questions on whether it will be a third round, and I certainly hope so. It's determined really through the Fire Service Advisory Committee that allocates the money, makes a recommendation to the Commissioner Doman on how we divide that up. But I've done everything I can to promote that program because I can see some real benefit long term.
Representative Ward.
Well, just finally, Mr. Chair, thank you. As Commissioner Dunesky, I hope you heard that, and we'll pass that message on. Thank you.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question is kind of prompted by your question, I think, but and I'm not sure if you'll have the answer to this, but I also don't know if anybody else will come before us that we'll be able to ask this to. But when we talk about the concept, you mentioned the concept county fire department, and I think about the concept of more of a regional or a district. And we've seen at least one case in Minnesota where we've created a fire district now, which what used to be the city of Cloquet Fire Department is now the Cloquet Area Fire District, which encompasses the city of Cloquet and at least one, if not two, surrounding townships. And I'm wondering if you can expand on that or tell the committee a little bit about that, if you have any background in that.
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, that you're absolutely correct, of course, that there's one or two that are actual fire districts. And by state law, currently the proponents of a district come forward to the legislature in order to get a law passed that allow them to be a taxing district. There's other arrangements around the state that are jointly working together based on joint powers agreements. There's a number of those. And a number of the shared services feasibility studies have identified that, you know, that is a one way to go. It just doesn't have the taxing authority. And actually the taxing authority issue is can be somewhat controversial in what I've seen around the country on similar studies and work on this particular topic is local municipalities and townships don't always want to give up that portion of the taxing decision. So that's why I don't think there's a lot of them currently, but it's an option that's being provided by these feasibility studies.
Other questions? Did Mr. Rosendahl, did I hear you say, or was it just what I thought I knew, that we had an increase in fatalities, fire-related fatalities last year, or is that?
Mr. Chair, and members, the 2010, I don't have the figures right in front of me, but it was, I believe, 39, and then 2011 went up to 56. And then this past year, 2012, we're in the low 50s. We haven't finalized those numbers yet.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
A follow-up to that question. So were more of those due to arson, or were they more due to accidental fires in the home, or what kinds of fires were they?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chair and members, the causes of structure fires go to cooking, heating, and open flame. The causes on fire deaths more so relate to alcohol abuse, drug abuse, smoking, and hoarding houses. Those trends are pretty much same throughout the whole series of years. We do a fire in Minnesota annual report, which breaks that down in detail, and those reports are all on our website too. If there's more analysis or if you'd like specific, I can certainly do that.
Mr. Rosendahl, can I ask, are you part of that task force that oversees the training centers for fire and law enforcement? There was every bonding year, it seems, legislators come with an idea to build a training center in their county or in their region, and they call it a regional training center and get millions of dollars in bonding money and then have their police or fire department located there. Are you part of that task force, or does it not exist anymore?
Mr. Chair and members, the task force you're referring to was most active, I'll call it, I believe, when Commissioner Campion, Assistant Commissioner Tim Leslie were in office. In terms of over a couple, 3 years, those reports being delivered here, and then those requests as they come in during bonding years relate back to those reports or studies. But yes, I have been on that task force.
So, Assistant Commissioner, does it still exist? I mean, do you still collect data on? Maybe it's a question. Maybe it's some information you can get me in the future. But it's been something that's troubled me for years here that. We are spending so much money in duplicating training services, and I just so if when Commissioner Leslie left, are you saying it left too? Mr. Rosendahl?
Mr. Chair and members, I mean, I think the meetings to prepare updated information quit at that particular time. There haven't been any additional meetings scheduled.
Okay. And whose responsibility is that to, I mean, is it a funding issue, or people just don't care, or what?
Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner.
From the time that Commissioner Dolman and I have been in the Department of Public Safety in our current roles, that group has not met. It was an ad hoc committee that was under Commissioner Campion, and I do believe that it issued kind of a final report on the recommendations of that task force, laying out the guidelines for Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3 training facilities across the state. And from time to time, as you mentioned, sir, when people come forward, they refer back to that report at times, talking about that tiered level of training facilities.
Maybe this is something for the chair of the Capital Investment Committee, but I mean, how would the legislature make sure that that data is being updated? Is that something you can do internally, or do you need legislation to do that?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't think that there was legislation forming the committee, so we could certainly draw that committee back. I think that we would be interested in specifically what you're interested in updating that.
How about this? How about if I think the committee should probably it would be good for you to make the report available to this committee so we can see, because just so I don't know how you, Representative Cornish, go. I don't know if he did this in the last biennium, but the bonding requests would often come through this committee that dealt with public safety. So I don't know if that happened here 2 years ago, but you know, you'll see a lot of bonding requests for these training centers, and they can be a good or a bad idea. I mean, but we're charged with ensuring that public funds are not being wasted and services aren't being duplicated, and it becomes sort of a political parochial thing that everyone wants their own training center. And so anyway, I don't think we should lose that. That was really a good idea that happened in the last administration.
Mr. Chair, what I can do is I can provide that the last report that we have on that, and I will also try to provide a map of the Tier 1, 2, and 3 facilities that currently exist in the state of Minnesota for the
committee as well. That would be very good. And then, I have some questions here before I... Representative Schoen and then Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, and to the fire marshal, what I'm looking for is response by your department, and particularly maybe the arson investigators. You have 12. I'm curious to where that number lies as far as staffing levels lie over the last 10 years. And then, you know, how are your numbers compared to 10 years ago today and in between? I mean, are you more, are you less? And then your responses. I mean, how many fires, how many? And I realize they do training and public outreach and those types of things. And so I realize that the numbers don't just lie on the fire response alone. Right. But what are they responding to? And then as you look out into these communities, you know, it kind of makes me wonder why did those communities need to evolve their fire arson investigation? Are we lacking somewhere, or is this where they just saw a need that there's that intermediate need? Because I look at the state as this is a pretty severe incident and that it's not your sole role to come out and investigate every fire, and I think that's important for people to understand. So, but where are the numbers at as far as responses?
Mr. Chair and members, the number of our investigation staff, which I was saying is currently at 11 plus an chief investigator, that has varied over the last 10 years, maybe by one or two. There was probably a point where we were at 10, we're at 11 now. I think there was a point where we had 12, or I doubt it, we were even at 13, but I could get that for you. So it's pretty much been stable. The comparison of that staff to the number of investigations, the number of total investigations we do per year has run in between 360, 75 up to 500 over the last 10 years, I would say. And today we're doing, partially because of these countywide investigation teams and more local fire marshals and chiefs getting trained in investigations, the ones we're going to today are more difficult, more specialized, more complex than the ones we were generally going to. We don't do empty buildings, you know, we do very few car fires and shed fires because we can. What we do is we talk to the local investigator on scene. They still go through the duty officer, and our investigator will talk to the local and just say, well, have you checked this? Have you looked at this? And you know, we kind of provide a counseling service, if you will, for the locals, because we don't go out on nearly the number that we did of those smaller categories. And I'm not sure if there was a follow-up or additional question.
Representative Schoen.
Actually, no, that was quite helpful. That's all I needed. Thank you.
And we will be looking at the budget in more detail, so some of the, we can ask some deeper questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at any point do you get called out when there's like a wildfire that's getting close to homes, or do you have any role in that?
Mr. Chair and members, that on wildland fires, the DNR has investigators that they're the primary on wildland fires. We work with them if there's joint issues, or if it gets into structures, or if they're looking at a particular pattern or MO, if you will, on fires. But typically, wildland fires are taken care of by the DNR.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Rosendahl? I would when you present your budget, when we get to that, I would like. You can talk about the fire safety account, but that's always been sort of a controversial issue here. So it still exists, I take it?
Mr. Chair, the fire safety account exists, and I think last session the percentage on the surcharge was adjusted. But other than that, we do an annual report on each fiscal year on how those were those monies were spent. Those are available.
Okay. So, yeah, it would be helpful to know all the different revenue accounts that come under your jurisdiction when we do your budget. But any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rosendahl. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Assistant
Mr. Chair, next is the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. It's the Director, Chris Idy.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. My name is Chris Idy, and I am the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We, too, are a division of the Department of Public Safety located downtown St. Paul in Town Square, and we are currently at a complement of about 76 full-time equivalents in our division. Our operating budget is approximately $8.7 million, but a very small portion of that actually comes from the state's general fund. Only $1.8 million comes from the state general fund. The majority of our money does come from the federal government through the Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, and then a portion also comes through an assessment of XL Energy for the planning and training and exercising requirements for the two nuclear power plants that they own and operate. We manage about 15 state and federal grant programs that provide approximately $80 million to local units of government, and we provide about 300 of those grants every year. Homeland Security and Emergency Management, or HSEM, is committed to the outcome of people in Minnesota are safe. Our mission really is to help Minnesota prevent, mitigate, prepare for, recover from all natural and human-caused disasters. The primary purpose really is to ensure that we have resilient communities that are prepared to respond to those emergencies and have the resilience to quickly recover from any effects of disaster. As you know, we frequently have disasters in this state, and we average about one significant event every year over the last 50 years, but in the last 5 years, we have had 10 presidentially declared disasters. So it is continuing on a more frequent basis, and the damage has been actually getting more. And I'll talk about that in just a little bit when I talk about our future challenges. We did begin in 1951 as the Department of Civil Defense in the Cold War. When Department of Public Safety was created in 1970, we became the Division of Civil Defense. And then as our mission changed over the last few years, we went from emergency services to emergency management. And then in 2004, following the 9/11 attacks in 2001, Homeland Security was created, and we then were became a merged Homeland Security and Emergency Management division. As I said before, the mission is to help Minnesotans prevent and prepare, and the circle on the overview form that you have in front of you really shows that it's a never-ending cycle. One of our challenges is that individuals really don't know who we are and what we do. And a question that we get a lot of times is, well, when there's not a disaster, what is it that you do? We ensure that there are that we know what hazards there are in our communities. We know what capabilities our local communities have, the gaps that exist, and how we need to fill those gaps, whether it's through building a capability, buying some kind of equipment, doing training, creating some kind of special teams that we have done over the past. So some of the things that we do in the prevention area really is we work with our Fusion Center, which is located at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We have exercise programs that we make sure that we can prevent some kind of future damage. We have hazard mitigation that we work with the Department of Natural Resources, and we work with FEMA through several grant programs and planning with local communities on how they can identify their opportunities to create a more resilient community. So we have about 5 folks that work with those communities to do that. We also have created the See Something, Say Something campaign, which you may be aware of, which is really a national best practice working with our communities, our airport, Metro Transit, on what it is that you may see some behavior, and then to call your local law enforcement if you feel that there are behaviors or abandoned packages and those types of things, so that you make sure that you are part of the prevention and don't ignore those things that you may see that may trigger some thought in your head that might not be the way things are supposed to be. We administer grant programs, and through that we have the State Homeland Security Grant Program. We have the Urban Area Security Initiative. We have Operation Stone Garden, which we work with the border communities and the Customs and Border Protection to ensure that our local communities are prepared to assist border protection in ensuring that we don't have the illegal crossings of the borders. We work very closely with the Department of Homeland Security and our critical infrastructure. Critical infrastructure being those pieces of infrastructure that, if were damaged, would create not only a financial implications to the state of Minnesota, but to the country. We focus on things that we call lifeline sectors, which are water and energy, telecommunications. Everything needs to have water. We make sure that we work with the Department of Commerce on their energy emergency plans so that we can ensure that if we have large shortages of energy, that we can have some of those plans in place. So we really are the coordinating agency and kind of the oversight agency of overall prevention, protection, and preparedness for state agencies. One of the important things that we've done this last year is really working with our ports and our waterways. We have 70 million tons of cargo that moves through into the port of Lake Superior and to the Minnesota and the Mississippi River basins. So we want to make sure that we can continue to provide that economic boost by boosting the security in those areas. So this is a public-private partnership that has worked quite well with leveraging private money and grant money to the local communities that that we administer from the Department of Homeland Security.
Ms. Heidi, do you have a satellite office in Duluth then for handling security at Lake Superior or no?
We work with the Coast Guard there. The person actually works in our office here, but we work directly with the Coast Guard. We do have six Homeland Security regions around the state. The person that focuses on the Northeast is actually in Grand Rapids. So each of our regional coordinators have about 16 to 18 counties that that they provide coordinative services and oversight for.
Ms. Heidi, can I just go back one step before us move forward? So the when something like the Minneapolis bridge collapse happens, what's the how do you get involved, and what's the chain of command there? I thought it was handled really well, but I. How does that work?
For Mr. Chair, for every incident that occurs, there is a local incident commander. So in this incident with the 35W bridge collapse, the local incident manager was the Minneapolis Fire Department. So they put an incident commander on scene. My role, actually, as Director of Homeland Security Emergency Management, is an advisor to the governor and the state response coordinator. So we operate the State Emergency Operations Center. We have representatives from the federal government, from voluntary agencies, from all the state agencies in the State Emergency Operations Center, so that we can provide subject matter experts, we can provide resources to any kind of a disaster. So for that example, the bridge fell on a train. The train had hazardous materials in it. We sent our technical expert in hazardous materials to meet up with the incident commander to determine what they were going to do. We sent a chemical assessment team to the train to test to make sure what kind of a chemical it was so that we would know how to mitigate the problems. We also then provided a joint information center so that we could coordinate the public information between Governor Pawlenty, Mayor Rybak, the folks with the state agencies and the federal government, so that we could all be speaking with one voice. And it did go very, very well. And it's because we train together and we exercise together and we coordinate on a regular basis.
Hey, Ms. Heidi, where is the State Operations Center? Is that what you called it?
Yes. The State Emergency Operations Center is down in our town square.
It is there.
Building in the middle of downtown St. Paul.
And can members of this committee take a tour of that if they wanted
to? Absolutely, they can. Okay. We'd be happy to have you.
Okay, very good. Please proceed. Representative Ward?
Mr. Chair, to your point, it's a great point, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Heidi, it's nice to personally meet you face-to-face because I've talked to you on the phone a number of times. We had, to your point, with the floods recently, the Duluth flood that carried down into Aiken County, to Crow Wing County, we had significant immediate needs and problems with that whole situation. And there were some of our local responding folks that said, we can't do this, you can't do that, you can't. And Ms. Heidi and her team got involved and immediately collaborated all the efforts. So it's not just within the metro area that this is helpful. It's greater Minnesota as well. And she actually gave her own many of us her own personal phone number to say, okay, when you need this help and you have questions, call me anytime. And so I just want to, so I've seen it in live action and it works very, very well. And she's able to redirect people that say, no, you can't do this. Well, yes, you can because of this or whatever. And I just appreciate the efforts that you have done, not only in the metro, but around the whole state of Minnesota. So I've seen it work, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Representative Ward.
It must be your day, Ms. Heidi.
I'm on a roll. Mr. Chair, you asked about the Emergency Management Training Center's advisory committee, and I was also on the advisory committee, which determined the need for different levels of training with type 1, type 2, type 3, Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 kind of training. Tier 3 being statewide integrated training and exercising. And so this past April, we opened up the Emergency Management Training Center up at Camp Ripley. So it was a collaboration of the response disciplines, the Minnesota National Guard, the Department of Public Safety, and we opened this state-of-the-art, technologically savvy Emergency Management Training Center where we can bring groups, disparate groups in to train together, to exercise together. We can use the facilities that have been constructed by the National Guard using federal funds. We leverage the state funds for not only that portion, but we've also brought in things like rail cars so that chemical assessment teams can go up there and train. We've done damage assessment training up there using the small city that the National Guard has constructed. And it really is a very good facility for that type of training. We are in the process of revamping our certification program. So we do require that emergency management directors within the first 3 years of their appointment by their city or their county are certified to the standards of Minnesota Homeland Security and emergency management. And this center is in the center of the state and is located in a very good place that we can bring people together. We don't have to send people out to Emmitsburg, Maryland as much as we used to, so not only does it save money for local governments, but it also then creates that efficiency of doing it here in our own state and creating our own capabilities. We oversee some specialized response teams. We have 11 chemical assessment teams, which last year made 33 out-of-jurisdiction responses and 48 phone consultations to local responders who had a hazardous material incident. We also work with 5 structural collapse technical rescue teams, which make up the Minnesota Task Force 1, who responded to the Mall of America parking ramp collapse, trench rescue, grain bin rescue, and I believe a couple of years ago to the Sudan mine fire. We contract with 4 bomb squads, and we have created some efficiencies in these bomb squads in that they now specialize. So that with our hazmat teams, because they are so broad and there are more of them, we standardize their equipment because they do a lot of their local regional. Because we only have 4 bomb squads, 1 in Crow Wing County and the other 4 more in the metro area, they specialize so that their very expensive equipment can be used more often than having all 4 of them maybe not need to do underwater bomb detonations and those kinds of things. We also employ 3 on-call staff that provide the subject matter expert to the incident commander and either on-site or over the telephone. And as we were talking about our disaster response and recovery, we chair the Minnesota Recovers Task Force, which also works quite well. Every disaster we have, we pull this group of state and federal agency folks together to look at the needs of the survivors of the disaster, the communities, what kind of impacts they have, what can be eligible for federal disaster funds from any kind of federal agency, what can only the state do, and we also leverage a lot of those funds, and we set priorities for disaster recovery. We are 6 months into what is known as the Duluth flood, as you all know, the special session in August provided $150-some million for the recovery for the folks that were impacted for that. FEMA actually just left town last week, so they have lived in our state, about 140 of them since July of 2012, having left last week, finishing their last project worksheet for the city of Duluth. So we will now continue to process those projects over the next several years to get the community up to where it needs to be.
Ms. Ida, just on that mm-hmm. point, so I thought I read that Duluth, I don't know if the mayor was saying that, but the they didn't utilize all the funds that were available, or didn't need them, or people weren't applying for low interest or no interest loans for disaster relief up there. So what is that money come back to? Where does it go? The state.
Mr. Chair, members, that we did have some difficulty in getting people to take assistance. As you know, we're pretty hardy stock, and we want to make sure our neighbors are taken care of. And a lot of times people don't understand the programs as well. So we are continuing to educate the folks. We have long-term recovery committees up there. So they will be working up there again for the next couple of years, continuing to get these folks to try to get the resources that are available to them. There's misunderstandings with what is a forgivable loan. They also don't understand that that because they have to apply to the Small Business Administration for a loan, that they still can get money from the state that's a forgivable loan. Unfortunately, we did not get the individual assistance declaration from FEMA, so grants were not available. But through the Quick Start program for Minnesota Housing, it was forgivable loans if they remain in their home. The money that is paid back on those goes back into the Minnesota Housing Disaster Relief Fund. The money that is not spent can, if there are still continued needs in other areas, it is transferable to other agencies. So we appear to be getting more people that want to have their property bought out than we had originally thought. So what we can do is we can take the funds that were given into one program and the applications that come in for the buyout program, and we can actually transfer those kinds of monies. So if there is more in one agency, it can be transferred to another agency for use for the disaster survivors. The money actually does expire in 2 years. So June 30 of 2015, mm-hmm. that money will expire if not used.
Very good. Thank you.
Our future. You know, as we look to the future, we really have one major concern, and that is the changing of the climate and the extremes that we have already started experiencing. We have homes that have flooded that have never been in the floodplain. If you were at the Capital Investment Committee 2 weeks ago, you heard Dr. Seeley talk about the majority of our precipitation has actually been from severe events and not from normal precipitation. So we're continuing to see this pattern of more disasters, greater disasters, more extremes in the climate, whether it's drought or whether it's severe storms. So we're continuing to look at that. At the same time, Congress is saying that there are too many disasters. States aren't paying their share. Federal government shouldn't be responsible for all of the relief to states. So we're still fighting that perception that the president is declaring too many disasters when we're actually having more severe events. So that's really the most important focus that we really have. From the Homeland Security side, obviously homegrown violent extremists. We have the governor did put in his budget reinstatement of the School Safety Center, which is in my division, looking at the coordinated manner of the community and the school on assessing the risk, looking at the security of the facilities, doing active shooter training. We did that starting in 2007. The funding ran out in 2011, so we did have to lay off staff and tone down that program. but the $555,000 that he put in his budget for this year will start that program back. And that's all I have for you. I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Very good. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this we'll go back to the other point. Are we going to have more talks about budget in this area too?
Just so the committee knows, we have there's a seems to be we're having a little bit of a problem getting with our budget books with the kind of analysis that we had in the past. But we're hoping that we'll get that information one way or the other.
Okay.
Because we can't just act on their budget with this information. So
no, absolutely.
Just sort of overviews of what they're. I asked them all to if they could come and sort of give us this state of their organization and where they're going in the future and just sort of give us an overview, especially for new members. That's what we're doing today. But we'll get into that. Unless you have a specific budget question you'd like to ask, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, ma'am, I'm curious about the structural collapse team. I'm well acquainted more so with hazardous materials, but the your task force one, who makes that up?
Ms. Idy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, the Task Force 1 is made up by five different teams, Minneapolis, Bloomington, Dakota County. Also has structural engineers. It has physicians as part of it. It has search dogs. So it really is a coordinated team from local responding organizations.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair. I think in the process, I have a lot more questions about it, and mostly favorable, by the way, but I think we can get through that at another time.
Okay, very good. Representative Lugman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, first of all, I'd like to compliment you, on your training programs and things. As a former mayor, I had to go through the emergency response training, and most of our council did too, but wonderful training, and whether you have the floods in Duluth or whether you have a tornado that hits the city of Rogers or whatever, that training would never existed before. And I think the idea that local communities, local elected officials at least, can be grounded in some of the emergency response protocol is very good. And I just hope that, we all know elected officials change, mm-hmm. and I hope that that program is being kept up. I just have two very simple questions for you. What is the number on your staff, and what is your budget?
Ms. Idy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, our staff right now is 74, and our budget is budget is about if you don't count disaster, our budget is about $8 million a year. 1.852 comes from the general fund. The remainder come from other sources.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you.
That was it?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Oh, sorry, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for stepping out earlier, but there was some conversation about bonding, and I haven't had a chance to meet much with our committee here, but in the past, I and the committee haven't been too excited about training centers all over the state other than the up at Camp Ripley, and have probably looked at more putting money into that or for centralized rather than sprinkling around, and the same view as we had on the labs. Rather than have labs all over the state, I've always supported the state one at BCA, and so everybody wants their own training center, but unfortunately we can't afford it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're on the same page there, but as you'll see, there'll be a slew of requests coming in from all over the state. So, and you were gone, but they're going to provide us with the reports of where all those centers are and the three different tiers and so the task force is it an ongoing task force or it's just not going on right now, Ms. Idy?
Mr. Chair, it is not going on right now since we finished the design of the emergency vehicle operations course. But what has happened in the past has been when there has been request for a regional training center. The chair of the committee has gone to the commissioner's office to take a look at that request and asked for a response from the department.
Okay, so Assistant Commissioner, you know we want to still probe that a little bit more to see if that task force can't meet. I mean, it seems to me that whole document should be updated. And so, okay. Anything else? Ms. Idy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have any? We have 30 minutes left.
Mr. Chair, next on our list was Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, if you want to stay in that order.
That sounds good.
Very good.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Michelle Tuckner. I'm Director of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement for the Department of Public Safety. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. My time is limited. I'll try to be brief over the next 10 minutes. I'll try to give you an overview of our division as well as any successes and challenges that we faced. A little history on the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Was formed in 1934. The Liquor Control Division was formed shortly after Prohibition. It was a standalone division. In 1974, it came under the was transferred to the Department of Public Safety. In 1989, the Gambling Enforcement Division was formed. In 1996, they merged the two, believing that alcohol and gambling went hand in hand, and they have been together ever since. As a division, we are both a regulatory agency and a law enforcement agency, which is rather unique, so we have that responsibility of both enforcement and regulation of those two industries. We're a small division, approximately 20 people. We have six licensing staff, six sworn agents with three vacancies that we're filling this week, and then we have 4.5 alcohol agents, which make up the 20 people in our division. I'll start on the alcohol side of the division. I talk rather fast, so this will go quickly. I was appointed director a little over a year ago, shortly after we initiated a strategic redirection plan. And as a result, we developed a new mission and vision statement, which you'll see in the, hopefully you have the AGED strategic handout and fact sheet there. The mission of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division is to protect and serve the public through the uniform interpretation and enforcement of the state's liquor and gambling laws and rules. The Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division acts to maintain stability and integrity in the alcoholic beverage and gaming industry through the management of licensing, education, enforcement, and regulation. Also listed on there, our group came together and worked to develop that strategic plan with the input from everyone. We have our vision and our core values that are listed there on that sheet as well. Our budget, AGD, is primarily funded general funds, but we do receive some special revenue funds, and we do have some statutory appropriations as well. Our budget is approximately $4 million over the biennium. So what do? On the alcohol side, we protect and serve the public through the Uniform Interpretation and Enforcement of the State's Liquor Act. We monitor, issue, approve, or certify liquor licenses and permits. We conduct inspections of new license applicants. We register and maintain brand labels. We collect license fees. Fiscal year 12 was approximately $2.8 million. We conduct alcohol compliance investigations. Last year we had approximately 53 civil penalties, totaled approximately $20,000. We collect, maintain, and assure minimum standards for dram shop and workers' comp insurance. We inspect product for damage. Chris Idy had mentioned the floods up in Duluth. Our agents responded to examine product up there to make it was safe before it was allowed to be distributed. We approve industry advertising. We answer a multitude of industry inquiries. And we serve as a central source of information to ensure records are available to the appropriate agencies and to the public. With the expansion of the alcohol industry, and we've had to evolve in how we perform our duties. We spend a lot more time fielding inquiries and answering approving advertising for the industry, and we're not able to be out in the field as much as we once were. We're currently looking forward and trying to find ways to develop new methods to provide training so that we can free up some of our staff time so that our staff can be in the field and being a little more proactive in interacting with the industry. On the gambling side,
I ask you one question. I thought the liquor licenses were all local matters.
There are different, some are issued by the local entities. We issue 33 classes ourselves. Approximately a little over 3,400 of the licenses issued are issued by us. Some are approved by us. They have to send in certain documentation. We review and approve, and then some are just certified to us. So there's different levels of response to the different types of licenses.
What are you looking at when someone applies for a liquor license?
It depends upon which type. If it's a type that we issue, we would do the inspection of the facilities. We would assure all the paperwork. In some cases, we have to do some background investigation. As a local entity, if a city sends a license to us, we're looking more for is the proper information provided? Do they have insurance? And is all the documentation correct as presented?
Okay. Thank you.
On the gambling side, we license and regulate the manufacturers and distributors of gaming devices. We monitor compliance of the state tribal compacts. We do that through the completion of routine inspections, technical upgrades, and annual reviews of the audits. We perform inspection on slot machines, both manually and through data reports. We provide support and investigative services for the Minnesota Gambling Control Board, the Minnesota Racing Commission, and the Minnesota Lottery. We conduct investigations of illegal forms of gambling. We conduct criminal history and fingerprint checks for our clients and for the tribal properties. And then we provide assistance to local law enforcement with alcohol and gambling-related criminal and civil cases. The technology explosion has changed gambling for us a lot. It's everywhere. It's on your smartphone. It's on your iPads. It's at the gas pumps. It's in the bars, and it's at the casinos. As a result, we've really needed to evolve with that. We're hiring new agents. We're looking for people with IT backgrounds, and our current agents are really having to step up their training and become very technologically savvy, so that's been a real challenge for us. Some emerging issues and trends that we're seeing.
Can I ask you a question? I don't remember. Sure. You know, my mind is going blank. But was there not an issue that happened vis-a-vis racing in the past year that was problematic for your division?
Mr. Chair, did you say the Racing Commission?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members. The three state agencies that are our clients, that being the Racing Commission, the Gambling Control Board, and the Minnesota Lottery, at times contact us about various issues that arise. In this case, it was a new type of table game that they were interested in expanding into the card rooms. And we take a look at that, look at the statutes, look at the laws, and try to determine if, in fact, that would meet the criteria and would be legal. We consult with our staff counsel to make certain that we've got a correct interpretation. And in the case of the Racing Commission, the game that they were looking to advance and the technology they were looking to advance there did not fulfill the statutory requirements, and that was the information that we provided back to them.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you. There's a certain legislator around here who shall remain nameless who always runs a Final Four pool. And I'm not going to say for the record. I think this is memorialized for the record. But at what point, for folks who run an office pool like that or something, what can you do and what can't you do? At what point do you come in for the average citizen?
Mr. Chair, members. Second. Towards the end of my presentation, I comment on two of our biggest challenges, and one of those challenges is what you've just mentioned. It's educating the public about the laws. People start fundraisers or decide they're going to have a poker tournament in a bar, and the gambling laws are the farthest thing from their mind. the type of incident you're talking about, we don't step in unless we get a complaint. We don't have the staffing to look at every single office pool final four. When we do get a complaint, though, then we're forced to take a look at it and see what's going on, what was the activity, what was the behavior. Primarily what we do in most cases, in many cases, people don't know the law. They just don't know it. So we put out what we describe as advisory letters. We tell you, stop it. This is the law. This is what you can and can't do. And we send out lots and lots and lots of advisory letters.
Sure.
Not a blast.
So can he do the pool or can't he?
My guess is, Duckner, the way you're describing it, sir, probably not. Without more of an investigation, I wouldn't be able to answer that question better than that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I never registered an actual complaint unless yes. I lose, so we'll see what happens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Left, so noted. All right, some emerging trends and issues that we're seeing in the alcohol industry. Producers of wine, beer, and spirits want more freedom to decide what to do with their products, anything from tastings to retail sales. It begins to blur the lines of the three-tier system that was established after Prohibition. It's primarily a commerce issue. We are regulatory, and we do report to the Commerce Committee as well. Our primary concern here today would be is when it crosses those lines to public safety, so we watch those trends as well. Internet alcohol sales, we've seen a real growth of internet alcohol sales. We're not able to regulate it. There's not licensing in Minnesota specifically required. I don't believe taxes are collected on that. And our bigger concern from a public safety perspective is the ability to control whose hands it gets into. By law, that product needs to be delivered and assigned to by someone over 21, and we're not there to be able to control that either. So those are not one of the trends that are concerning to us. In the gambling industry, everything is becoming technology-driven. Internet sweepstakes cafes are sweeping the country. These cafes are something like they sell you a phone card or computer time or what they call workstation time, and in exchange they give you credits to play a game on a computer that looks like slots. You accrue credits. At the end, you cash out your credits and you go to the cashier and you collect cash. It's illegal gambling, and it's not regulated. Customers aren't protected.
Suckner, we have a question from a member, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You stated that internet sales of liquor is not licensed in this state and it's not regulated. Is that something that's outside our ability to do that, or is it done federally? Or
Ms. Suckner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, members, I'll answer as much as I can. I've been in the role about a year, so I don't have all the nuances of the alcohol licensing section down. But my understanding is that they have to be licensed in their state. Currently, they're allowed to ship wine into Minnesota. I believe it's up to two cases. But who controls it? And one of the bigger concerns that we've heard and seen is they may ship two cases of wine to your house, but as you know, a lot of the companies, they're not having someone over the age of 21 signed for that product, and so we're not always comfortable that it's not staying secure. So there isn't specific licensing in Minnesota to that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Are we prohibited from requiring that in Minnesota? I mean, is there something in federal law that would prohibit us from requiring people who ship things over the internet to sign, have someone over 21 sign for it?
Ms. Tuckner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not familiar with any Minnesota law that allows us to require it at this time. Just looking to my alcohol agent that's got most of the answers back there, so don't want to provide you inaccurate information. Okay. Continuing, we talked about the internet sweepstakes cafes. We had one of our arrests up in St. Cloud, the Triple Crown. We went in, served a search warrant, shut the operation down, and they have reopened. And so we are continuing and opening a new investigation on them. Internet gaming is a concern and a trend we're seeing. It's everywhere. It's on your Facebook account. You can play with pretend credits. You can go online. You can play poker for real money. Not legally in Minnesota, but you can. And both of those are unregulated. There's no way right now for us to ensure the integrity of that gaming. And then another technology issue for us is how the growth of the technology has impacted the state and tribal compacts. The compacts were signed in 89 and didn't have the technology that we have today. Today's slots are computer-based, and the current language doesn't allow for some of the IT functions needed to operate the devices. Some of it can be addressed with a technical amendment, but some cannot. On a more positive side, we've had a number of successes that we're very proud of. We've streamlined the buyer's card process for faster processing and issuance. That's the retailer ID card. Our old buyer's card had to be printed on a dot matrix printer with pre-printed cardstock. Now we can use plain paper. It's cheaper, it's faster. We don't have to wait to print in batches. We've done a Kaizen event with our brand label registration process. We've reduced processing time from 30 days to 2 days. And we've eliminated 30 days of a backlog of processing and filing. We've also leaned our off-sale license process. We've reduced that processing time from 14 days to 2 days. We're eliminating or reducing postal mailings wherever possible and trying to make notifications with email. And most importantly, we're in the very early transitioning stages to an e-licensing process for all licensing types, which will dramatically reduce our processing time for licensing.
Question, Representative Ward?
Mr. Chair,
please proceed.
On the alcohol side, we've also noticed that despite the growth in the alcohol industry and the number of licenses issued, we're seeing a decline in the number of complaints. We've also seen a significant increase in the number of inquiries. I'd like to think that this suggests better voluntary compliance. People are asking first before they're taking action. We've had a 16% decline in complaints and a 44% increase in inquiries. We've also renewed our focus on the state and tribal compact compliance. We're focusing on performing more inspections of all 18 casinos, as well as blackjack inspections at those sites. And we've completed annual audit reviews for all our tribal properties. We've also had an increase in criminal history checks for those applying for work in the gaming industry. The increase is 15%, while our processing time has been reduced by half. We do have some challenges. Basically, it's keeping up with the rapid expansion of gambling. It's everywhere, and it's very difficult to regulate and take enforcement action. We're watching the trends, and we're trying to anticipate how we might have to change or adapt to address the new issues and the new forms of gambling that are being created. We also struggle with educating the public about gambling laws. Most people don't even think of them when they're trying to start a fundraiser or a poker tournament. We send out many advisory letters, but we need to find ways to better educate the public about the laws. And then there's the future for us, for my division, for me. I'm all about asking why. I drive my people crazy with the question why we do things the way we do. But we're going to harness the technology that we have. We're going to work smarter and more efficiently. And our goal is to develop an online licensing system that will take an application from start to finish quickly. It'll interface for the customer, the city, the county, the Tax and Trade Bureau, and any other entity that has a necessity to touch that license. It'll support online payments and be easily accessible and usable for all, and there's no reason we can't have that. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them now. Also on the back sheet of the fact sheet has got our contact information for both myself, one of the gambling agents, and one of the alcohol agents. If you have questions in the future, don't hesitate to contact us. We'd be happy to help.
The three sworn agents that you're going to, the positions you're going to fill, are they in gambling or alcohol?
They are sworn positions. Our sworn agents do work some alcohol work when necessary, but primarily gambling.
And what is your biennial budget? I know we'll get into this in more detail.
It's, Mr. Chair, with the statutory obligations, it's just a little over $4 million biennial.
Right. Representative Ward had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Tuchner, very interesting. I want to go back to a bullet that you didn't touch on in alcohol license enforcement activity. Says you're responsible for the collection of approximately $13 million in delinquent liquor sales tax sales tax annually. And then you ended your presentation by saying that you are going to look at technologically effective, efficient means of. So tell me, so this $13 million annually, is it from the same people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, members, when retailers and others in the alcohol industry don't pay their taxes, they are posted to a tax list. And what occurs is they're not allowed to buy further product. Through our inspections, we uncover when this occurs, and they are not allowed to continue to operate until those taxes are paid. So that number that I produce there is generally we get that information from revenue, the Department of Revenue, when those taxes are paid. And so is it the same people? It's the alcohol industry folks who aren't keeping current on their taxes, but who those individuals are, I'm sure, change.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. So is there a more effective, efficient, better way to handle that than the current system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, members, if you're referring to the licensing process I talked about, e-licensing versus the tax collection, they're sort of separate. The licensing is the electronic side. The tax collection is something that the person's licensed, but they don't stay current on their taxes, and then they fall out of grace. And so it's not something our e-licensing system could catch or fix.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, yeah, obviously we collect a lot of license fee money from alcohol licensing and things. What about our fee income from gambling, particularly racetracks, casinos, things like that?
Ms. Tickner.
Mr. Chair, members, I thought I had all the answers with me today, but apparently I don't. I can get you that information on how much is actually collected from gambling licenses. We have 27 manufacturer licenses that license to us. I don't know what the fee is. I can get you a number. It's significantly smaller because we don't have as much of that type of licensing activity.
Representative Uglum.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up. Well, you know, we've got almost a $4 million budget here, and I guess I'm really interested in seeing what the income side of it is for your department across the board. If we could have that information, I think it'd be helpful.
Sure.
Thank you.
The limited budget books that we have, Mr. Walsh just showed me that it's $4 million general fund appropriation. There's $4 million from other funds. I'm assuming those are licensing fees, or I don't know if you would get any federal funds, but I don't know. That I think that is a good question, and we should explore. I mean, if you're understaffed too, that's a problem. If gambling is expanding at the rate that we all know that it is.
Mr. Chair, members, I tried to look at the budget numbers that I believed you had and then looked at the numbers that I know that we have, and I was trying to bring those in alignment. And one of the things that the numbers show is for each fiscal year, it's $2.236 million, but $500,000 of that, and then $653,000 through special revenue. Of that, $500,000 each year is transferred out. We do receive approximately, through our statutory appropriations, another $260,000. We receive $150,000 each year from the tribes, and then another $110,000 through fingerprint and criminal history checks. So my operating budget, by as I know it, not by the numbers that are on your paper, is about $3.9 million for the biennium. With what I have to operate with. And I know that the numbers look a little different there. I was trying to square that up, and I know that the system's not really producing the reports that would be helpful right now.
So are they increased at all? Like, are the tribal fees increased at all annually?
Mr. Chair, the fees related to the tribes, the compact funds, are set in that compact from 1989, and those remain the same. And the licensing fees, as you know, go to the fund. They don't come direct to AGED. The only licensing fee we get directly is the micro distillery fee, and last year that was $4,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Oh. Yep. So hopefully we'll get more information when we get into that budget also. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. I think, Assistant Commissioner, any closing words?
Mr. Chair, thank you. We'll look forward to scheduling the remainder of our divisions with you. Mr. Chair, I know that Representative Cornish had a couple of questions that he wanted answered during this session. With your permission, would it be okay to have those questions answered when the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension comes forward?
That would be fine. I met with the commissioner this morning, and we talked about having several days for the BCA, just because there's so many issues with databases, and the governor's change items are primarily in that area, and we want a couple of days with OJP, so that's the plan. And can you just tell us when the tour of the BCA is? February 19th, this will be the tour of the BCA, and that's the tentative date that we have scheduled. Is that a Friday? That's a Friday. Oh, it's during committee. So I don't know if people want to take a bus there or just drive there and be on your own. It's right in pretty close. Okay. We'll send out some announcements and... All right, if there's no other business before the... Sorry, I need a motion to approve the minutes of January 23rd.
So moved.
Representative Ward moves the minutes be approved. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. We're adjourned. Thank you.